I need to be the calming voice, the one that doesn't sweat in public, the one that can look at the situation and offer options on where do we go from here, and getting ahead of the issue as opposed to trying to put the fire out after the fact.
Constraint, strive, innovation. Hey everyone, it's Matt here for another episode of Thinking Inside the Box, a show where we discuss complex issues related to work and culture. If you're interested in checking out our other content, you can find us at bentohr.com and wherever you find your favorite podcasts by searching Thinking Inside the Box. And if you enjoy the work we're doing here, consider giving us a 5-star rating, leaving a comment, and subscribing. It ensures you get updated whenever we release new content and really helps amplify our message. In today's episode, I chat with Mark Romig, the Senior Vice President and Chief Marketing Officer of New Orleans & Company, the New Orleans tourism industry's destination marketing and sales organization. Now, Mark has a pretty interesting background. His public relations career has spanned more than 4 decades, from teaching in college classrooms to the 1984 Louisiana World's Fair, from working as a staff assistant to the U.S. Department of Transportation Secretary Elizabeth Dole, and on the 1987-88 presidential campaign of U.S. Senator Bob Dole. And then in 2013, Mark became the stadium announcer for the NFL's New Orleans Saints in the Mercedes-Benz Superdome, succeeding his father, Jerry, who served in the same role for, wait for it, 446 consecutive games over 44 years. Mark is also a member of the board of directors of Fidelity Bank, headquartered in New Orleans. In today's discussion, Mark and I cover a lot of ground, from his professional journey, complete with some really compelling twists and turns, to how he took up the challenge of cementing his father's legacy while forging his own path. It was a real pleasure hunting with Mark, and I hope you enjoy it. And now I bring you Mark Romig. Mark, every guest is a little bit unique on this podcast, and you might be a little bit more unique than the average guest that I have. And I say that with the most amount of affection possibly. I am really excited for this conversation. I'm excited to hear your story, your background, more about one of my favorite cities, New Orleans. Thanks for joining us today.
It's great to be with you, Matt.
I think before we get started, Mark, it would be really helpful for our audience to understand a bit more about you, your background, your experiences, and what led you to today.
Thank you. And thanks for giving me the opportunity to share. I am a native of the city of New Orleans. I grew up in an area called Lakeview. My family was very involved in that part of town in the parish that we were located in, St. Dominic Parish. I have a number of brothers and sisters, and we were very family centric. My dad worked for the NBC affiliate WDSU for many, many years. So we grew up experiencing all the great joys of hanging out with in a television studio as kids. As dad worked, he would bring us up there on a weekend, and we just had a playground of sorts. And we had a great time meeting all sorts of celebrities, folks from Bonanza, Roy Rogers, the Three Stooges, Bob Hope, you name it, these celebrities would come through. And we just thought they were just so neat. And our neighbors thought we were so neat because we got to hang out with some of these celebrities. So we had a pretty exciting childhood. And as I grew up, I thought I wanted to be a dentist. And so I attended the University of New Orleans in a pre-dental program, and literally found out that chemistry and I would not get along at all. And so hit a brick wall there. My dad counseled me out of a pre-dental program and said, son, you might want to consider this new hospitality program that there was starting at the University of New Orleans. And sure enough, it did attract me. I was always, people-oriented, service-oriented, wanting to please people. And of course, in hospitality, that needs to be a major passion if you're going to be successful. And so I entered the hotel, restaurant, and tourism program at the University of New Orleans. And really, looking back, that was the most important decision I made at that young age. I went on to work for the Intercontinental Hotel Organization, I worked for the Louisiana World's Fair in protocol and guest relations. I went on to work in Washington, D.C., lived up there for several years working in protocol or staff assistant work to the then Secretary of Transportation, Elizabeth Dole. Got to travel, learn the benefit of scheduling and the importance of that. But again, always in that service role, in this case to her as secretary and being a staff assistant. Then went on her presidential campaign with her husband's team. She left the Department of Transportation, went on the campaign. I went with her and we traveled for 6 months around the nation. Bob Dole was running in the primaries to try to win the primary back or try to win the Republican nomination back in 87 and 88. Obviously, it didn't work well. We did not find ourselves successful in that episode. So I came back to New Orleans, worked my way through some public affairs positions, but wound up at an agency, a public relations advertising agency, and found that many of my clients were involved in the tourism and hospitality industry, and further received experience working with various entities that way, and then ultimately became part of the tourism promotion of the city itself by working at the New Orleans Tourism Marketing Corporation as its president, CEO, and then that being merged into where I am presently at New Orleans and Company, which is the destination marketing and sales organization for the hospitality industry as a chief marketing officer. Through it all, it's been a great journey. Being from New Orleans and being able to promote my hometown is an honor as well as a pleasure. And I look forward to many more years doing that.
And what an incredible story. I mean, you know, as early back as your childhood, and you mentioned interacting with individuals that most people saw on the square boxes in their households and living rooms. I'm curious what level of impact that had on you and how that may have influenced decisions you made later in life.
Well, I certainly saw how it was important to be hospitable and to be open to all sorts of individuals and opinions, because when they were being hosted here in the city of New Orleans, I saw how my dad and his team at WDSU reacted and how they rolled out the red carpet and how the celebrities in that case reacted to that and how much they loved talking about their visits to the city. And it just struck me as something that's very important to be part of, and also and how to react to individuals, whether they're celebrities or not. You want to roll out the red carpet. It could be a family just visiting for the weekend or a convention coming in. I think it was important then, it is now, that people feel welcomed here in the city of New Orleans. And we welcome people from all faiths, from all beliefs, from all opinions. When they get to New Orleans, we want to make sure that they enjoy the city and that they leave with great memories. We like to say, follow your NOLA, N-O-L-A, New Orleans, Louisiana, and come in and participate and be part of the magic here that we find in the city of New Orleans. So I don't think we were spoiled as kids, because we didn't realize how special this was. We just figured this was that every family had the opportunity to meet Little Joe from Bonanza. But Dad made it very special for us. And I just think it also instilled upon us a responsibility early on to act accordingly, to act as a, in this case, a proper gentleman around guests that came in, and, you know, the protocols of shaking hands, yes, sir, no, sir, thank you. And, you know, I'm very fortunate looking back on that, that base that my parents provided us.
It sounds like it took you to Washington, where many of those lessons likely served you as well, working with political campaigns. And as you mentioned, the Dole campaign for the primaries. I think about the state of politics today, and I don't want to get into the details of it, but I think back at some of those earlier times, and I'm curious what it was like being embedded within a political campaign in 1987 at a very interesting inflection point for the United States. What were some of the things that you recognized or that stood out for you, or that maybe you learned along that journey?
Well, certainly that was well before social media. Things were more, I want to say, not as rushed. There were ways to communicate then that certainly have changed dramatically since then. The fax machine was still king back then, if you can imagine. Cell phones were just coming into use. I remember carrying around this huge block portable mobile phone back then. Communication throughout the campaign was done in a more orderly way. And the reaction time was slower to things that were occurring. Well, one story I'll tell you, I was traveling with Mrs. Dole in Wisconsin, and this was after Super Tuesday in 1988. And it looked at this point that then Vice President Bush was going to win enough delegates to secure the nomination. But the Dole campaign was still hanging on because there was a lot of expectation amongst his supporters that, you know, he'd stay in there and fight. But I think the decision was reached that was not going to be the case. But we were in Wisconsin, and the senator himself back in D.C., and he made a comment to someone on the air that he thought it was time that it was going to be the Vice President Bush's campaign to win. And Mrs. Dole was ready to go on the radio at a Wisconsin radio station. And it was only because it was on the news that Senator Dole had said that in Washington that it reached us in Wisconsin. And we realized what he was saying. And so she had to quickly adjust what she was going to be saying. And we left that station and got on a plane to get back to D.C. so that the campaign could, you know, organize its thoughts and itself on where we go from here, which was basically to suspend the campaign. But if you think about today's world, how that information would have traveled instantaneously, and perhaps the center was trying to reach Mrs. Dole, but, you know, by then it was had to capture by a telephone call or by a fax. It was just different. It was a different speed of communication.
Hey everyone, it's Matt here. I hope you're enjoying today's discussion. And before we continue, I wanted to make you aware of my latest creative project, This Week at Work. Presented in partnership with my good friend, Chris Rainey of HR Leaders, each Friday we'll live stream on LinkedIn at 7 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. That's 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time and 3 p.m. GMT for our European viewers. And together bring you the latest trends, news on topics emanating from organizations, everything from culture to technology and the future of work. Joining is easy. Just follow me on LinkedIn, click the bell at the top right-hand side of my profile, and you'll get notified when we go live each week. And whether you do experience the content live or later, if you've been following me for a while, you'll no doubt recognize the fun banter Chris and I have developed over the years. And whether it's been podcasts or digital events, we're so excited to again bring you the topics affecting today's workplaces and their leaders. And now, back to our discussion.
It was calmer, perhaps, though the issues were still as tough as they are now. But it was just a different way to communicate. And I think that's the biggest change I've seen over the years.
Well, and I appreciate that lens, Mark, on communication, because I know that in addition to the experiences that you've listed, communication's been a big part of your life, passing information back and forth, sharing information. And I'm curious for you, just like, again, observations that you've had around just the state of communication and how it's evolved.
Yeah, you know, I've always looked at crisis communication as my point of reference when I'm offering something to a client or to an individual, and being able to be the calm center of a growing storm. And, you know, to me, communication should provide an environment so that things can be done and two sides that come together, because communication really starts with two people talking and it grows from there. But if you can come on to a level playing field and have people speak clearly, succinctly, without any filters, I think a lot can get done in our world by offering an opportunity to create an environment that provides for good dialogue. But crisis communication, through the experiences that I've had over my years, where, you know, I need to be the calming voice, the one that doesn't sweat in public, the one that can look at the situation and offer options on where do we go from here, and, you know, getting ahead of the issue as opposed to trying to put the fire out after the fact is important too. But to me, the basis of our world, and particularly in solving all the issues that we do have, is good, honest communication. And I think it's been my passion, is to try to be part of good, honest communication processes.
And how does that extend to your work at the Superdome and as the New Orleans Saints stadium announcer?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I'm just following in the footsteps of my father, Jerry, who, as I said earlier, worked for the NBC affiliate here in the city of New Orleans. He went on to have a successful development career with the Archdiocese of New Orleans. And then he and I ultimately were able to work together at the agency that I spoke about earlier. Prior to that, he was a communications director for the large charity hospital here in the city of New Orleans. But back to the Saints, that was a Sunday gig that my dad had for 44 years. He never missed the game since the third year of the Saints back in 1969. It amounted to 446 consecutive games he called inside at the stadium, first at the old Tulane Stadium on Tulane's campus where the Saints initially played. And then when they moved over to the Superdome, which is now called the Caesars Superdome, he was the stadium announcer. There's another component to that. My brother Jay works for the Saints full time. He's the longest serving employee that they have now, some 46 years, I believe. He's the senior director of administration for the Saints. And then my sister, Mary Beth, spotted for my father. In other words, she would feed into Dad what she was watching on the field, and that would give Dad another basis of information so that he could make these calls rather quickly, because you only have so many seconds given by the NFL to speak about the action on the field. So Dad did this from 1969 to 2013. He stopped announcing at preseason, at the end of preseason in 2013. And because the Saints didn't want to disrupt sort of the atmosphere and the sound that the fans were used to for so many years. I mean, we're talking over four decades, they would hear my dad's voice. And because he and I share a similar, we joked about this, but I think it's really the benefit of how we sound, our nasal tone, a deviated septum. The Saints asked me if I would step in and become the announcer beginning in 2013. So I have been serving in the same role that my father served since 2013. So this will be my 10th year. The 2022 season will be my 10th year behind the microphone. And my sister, Mary Beth, continues to spot me as well. So she helps me sound like I know what I'm talking about.
It's truly a family affair. And that just brings a huge smile to my face. I can imagine there was a lot of pressure for you filling in those big shoes that your father left. You mentioned four decades, such an affinity for the fans and the fans for him. What was that first broadcast like?
I was a nervous wreck. Fortunately, my dad was in the stadium. He was seated in the owner's suite because at that game, they brought my mom and my dad down to the field to thank him for his many years of service. And so knowing that Dad was there listening and knowing that I would get good feedback gave me some sense of calm, though butterflies were very active in my stomach. But literally when I was able to make that first announcement for that very first game that I announced, and it was the Atlanta game in September of 2013. It was a really simple announcement, and it was like who was kicking off, because my work starts when the kickoff starts. There's another announcer that does all the pregame announcing, including this when the team comes onto the field, the national anthem. I'm strictly the play-by-play. So when I was able to push that button appropriately and speak that first line, I felt the comfort come back and like, okay, I can do this. And I just picked it up from there. I tried to emulate some of my dad's tonal approaches to some of the more specific announcements, like first down Saints or it's touchdown Saints, things like that, that the fans were used to. Because the important thing was let's not make it about the announcer being a new announcer. Let's keep their experience in the stadium as consistent as possible. And I think, fortunately, because of the sound that I emit is similar to what Dad did for his decades of work there, the fans actually for first couple of games, I would see somebody on the street after the game and they would say, "Hey, your dad sounded great at the stadium at the game." And so it was actually me, but so that was the biggest compliment.
And you always had a backup plan in case things that went sideways. I mean, it's a wonderful story. And I'm curious for you, because obviously you have such a deep affinity and respect for your father and his legacy and the things that he was able to, give to the fans of New Orleans. And as a young man, I'm sure you also want to forge your own path and be your own person. And I'm curious how you struck the balance between honoring that legacy, but also carving out your own path.
Well, you know, I never thought in all my years of growing up, and Dad always invited some of the kids to join him in the booth over the years. And, you know, I would be in there watching him at play and in action. And I never thought I'd be sitting there doing that. Of course, as kids and then even growing up as an adult, I thought Dad would live, you know, forever and keep doing that. That was what he did. So getting the opportunity to carry on his legacy, it was very, very special and something I will treasure forever. If I do it for 10 years or if my Lord, if I could do it for 44 years, as long as Dad, I'll be 110 years old when I would finish. It was just something very special. You know, I made my own way in the world. I got involved, as I said earlier, in the hospitality industry and tourism promotion. But, you know, in my family, there are two seasons, basically saint season and waiting for saint season. My mother coined that phrase, give her the credit. I mean, we revolve around the saint season as a family. We all have our other jobs. Dad worked full-time elsewhere. My sister works full-time here in New Orleans in company with me. But it's very special. And as you speak to other Saints fans around the nation, they'll tell you the same thing. I know every team has passion. There's a lot of passion here in New Orleans and Louisiana along the Gulf Coast for the Saints. And it is very, very, very special. I forgot to add to the story of my dad. My mother also went to 446 consecutive games. They were always together.
Oh, wow.
And they rode that travel together for those many years. In fact, when I was asked to take Dad's role, Mom reminded me that in previous games, I would leave maybe in the third quarter, or the beginning of the fourth quarter, leave, you know, beat the traffic, catch the rest of the game on the radio or on television, particularly back in the day when people were leaving the Saints games early. And it always kind of, I think, chapped Mom a little bit because she had to stay the whole game. And so she said, "Now, you know, Mark, now that you're the announcer, you have to stay the whole game." I said, "Yes, ma'am. I'm quite well aware of that, Mom. Thank you."
Wise words. You speak so glowingly, Mark, about the city which you call home, the city that you were born, that you were raised, that you've had such a big impact, and it's clearly had a huge impact on you. When I think about New Orleans, I think about a city that's just absolutely bursting with culture and passion and great food and great people. And also a city that's, as a consequence of the last 15 or so years, had to build a lot of resilience. There's been some really trying times in the New Orleans area. And I'm just curious from yourself, what that's been like as a native New Orleans resident, as somebody who has such a deep passion for his community, what's it been like being part of that over the last 15 or so years?
Thank you for that question, because it's something I've experienced in my adult lifetime, seeing the city have to come back after disasters such as Katrina and the BP oil spill and a number of other natural disasters that we've experienced, including the most recent one, Hurricane Ida. You know, that we live in that part of the world where that tropical weather will cause havoc. And, you know, we await. One thing that we can at least see is that we get enough notice because these storms normally will give a few days of notice before they're coming through. So we're preparing. We're constantly preparing. And we prepared for Betsy back in the 60s and Camille in the late 60s. And, of course, Katrina being that one storm that really knocked a wallop here and caused so much damage and devastation. But the city is 304 years old, and you can trace back centuries and issues of fires that had devastated the French Quarter, and the earliest hurricane on record after the city was formed back in 1721, when what was built was totally destroyed and they rebuilt back then. So this theme of resilience is strong throughout the history of the city of New Orleans. And I think it's baked into the people and the various cultures that have established the city. These are people who have come together and mixing this gumbo of people that we've done over the last several centuries. I think it's ingrained in us that we will always come back, that we don't give up, that we have a joy of life and living that we want to share with our family, friends, and the rest of the world. Yeah, it would have been really easy after Katrina to follow some of the politicians in D.C. who were questioning whether New Orleans should be even rebuilt. when you consider 80% of the city had water because of the failed levee system. But we were not going to hear that. We were going to come back. And as you know, the history, the federal response was slow at best. The people in New Orleans took it upon themselves and the people in this region to say, no, we're going to come back. And it was just sort of in our DNA to do that. And I see you can take that same attitude and story to so many things. The Saints, for instance, never gave up. You know, the new owner came in back several decades ago, put money into the Saints and decided we're going to keep fighting this until we bring a winner to the city of New Orleans. And sure enough, the Benson family brought a Super Bowl victory to the city of New Orleans. Same thing with people rebuilding their homes. There was all sorts of title insurance issues and ownership issues as it came to these homes that were owned by families over many generations. But, you know, insurance companies have certain rules about, well, you know, I need to see a title. And the federal government said, I need to see a title if I'm going to give you some relief. You know, some people just didn't have titles to their homes. These were just families who lived in these homes and it was being passed on to the next generation. But we fought back and we're still fighting in many ways, but we were not going to give up. Nobody was going to tell us that we could not rebuild our lives that we had here in the city.
And I can feel that resilience and that passion just coming through people that I speak with who've lived in the city, who frequent the city. And when most people think about New Orleans, Mark, they think about the typical tourist spots, the French Quarter and Mardi Gras and, you know, all the wonderful food and culture. What's something about New Orleans that most of us who haven't spent as much time as you have there, maybe something we wouldn't know?
Very good question, Matt. I think the fact that we have dozens of neighborhoods with its own culture, with its own life, 24/7. You know, we do have what people would consider the iconic French Quarter and the riverfront in the downtown area. And of course the Caesars Superdome and the National World War II Museum and the aquarium and the great restaurants, over 1,000 restaurants here. But, you know, you get out into the city of New Orleans, and you get out into the neighborhoods, uptown and downtown and the Bywater and Mid-City and Lakefront, the Lower Ninth Ward, New Orleans East. Each of these areas of our city have a rich history and tradition and family businesses. And, you know, in many ways, it's given rise to the short-term rental challenge that we all face in all cities. You know, it's important for us to fill our hotel rooms. You know, they're paying into the system with the hotel taxes, and that's helping us with city services, but also helping us with promotion. And just most recently, short-term rentals were put into a position where they also have to pay into the system, so to speak. But I think because we have been talking about our neighborhoods so much and our promotion of the city, that people decided, hey, I want to live out in those neighborhoods too. You know, I want to enjoy those neighborhoods and you know, renting a home for a couple of days or however that they manage that. So in many ways, that's something that people are starting to see more and more and experience more and more of all the neighborhoods that we have in the city of New Orleans. We still want people to enjoy a good hotel stay here, but we also want them to get out and spread their spending around the rest of the city so more people enjoy the spending that comes along with visitation.
So, Mark, I'm curious in your thoughts. When I think about New Orleans in particular, I think about a city that has a very loud voice, a very passionate voice. And in doing some research for this particular podcast, I was surprised to discover that the city itself is barely approaching 400,000 people. But yet it's such a cauldron, as you call it, a gumbo of different cultures. And I'm curious what observations you have from a cultural perspective as far as the city is concerned over the last, call it 10 years or so.
That's a very good question, Matt. You know, New Orleans for 304 years has been a melting pot of many cultures and, you know, forming what we like to consider to be this gumbo of people who are very resilient. But I think really over the last 10, 12 years, there's grown a great appreciation for those individuals and organizations that form the culture bearers. We're talking about the Black Masking Indians, the artists such as musicians, the people who are putting on productions here, really the backbone of why people come to New Orleans, because they want to experience that culture and be part of it. And with that has come a greater appreciation and respect for those culture bearers. I believe there's much more work to do there, but they are owed a great amount of reverence from us and thanks. And also, it's important for us economically to support the culture bearers and to build generations of future culture bearers, because really that's the essence of New Orleans. It's the people that have made New Orleans what it is today. And we can't forget that. And as we're promoting New Orleans around the world and we're featuring these beautiful visuals of these Black masking Indians or our musicians or the people that give New Orleans that special joy of life, we have to remember that and we have to respect that and treat that accordingly.
Mark, I'm curious, what's next for you?
Oh, wow. Next for me, of course, the 10th season at the Superdome as a stadium announcer for the New Orleans Saints. Of course, that's just a Sunday contract gig, but it brings so much joy to me as an individual and to be part of my family's process. As I said earlier, we've got two seasons, Saint season and waiting for Saint season. I'm also turning north toward the age of 70. I'm 66. And one thing I've always wanted to do, and I'm doing this with my family, is understanding how to operate a power boat so that one day I can, you know, find myself lowering my blood pressure by sitting on the back deck of a boat and just casting off a line to fish. But I don't see that happening anytime soon. I'm four square behind my job helping promote New Orleans and bringing visitors to the city of the New Orleans and in the New Orleans area. So I hope to continue working as chief marketing officer for New Orleans and Company for several more years. And I'm a big family guy. My family loves to get together on a regular basis, and we enjoy each other's company. We certainly have lots of stories we can always share with each other. And then also just spreading the joy of New Orleans around the world. I find that that's a mission that I truly love, and it's an honor to do, and I'll keep doing that.
Well, you're an incredible ambassador for your community, Mark. I want to thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to connect with us today. I certainly learned a lot about you and your background and the city of New Orleans. And I'm not going to lie to you, on the side of my desk here, I've had my apps opened up and looking at flights. It's a wonderful place. Thank you so much for your time and looking forward to keeping in touch.
Thanks, Matt. And best wishes to you and yours.
Bento HR is a digital transformation consultancy working at the intersection of strategy, technology, and people operations. We partner with organizations, private equity, and venture capital firms to accelerate value creation and identify the organization's highest leverage initiatives. And this can take place in many forms, from strategic planning and alignment to technology, procurement, implementation, and integration, along with organizational design, process reengineering, and change management. With our proven track record of working with complex, high-growth organizations, we provide a lens that goes beyond the balance sheet, increasing enterprise readiness, resilience, and value. For more information, check us out at bentohr.com.